I'll be back in an hour.
And we are on. Today is Friday, August 27th, 2010. My name is Meredith Horn, a graduate student of public history and the intern for an oral history project recording the memories of individuals who have significant association with and knowledge of IUPUI. Funding comes from the University Library, the Department of History's Public History Program, and the University Administration's 40th Anniversary Fund, administered through the IUPUI Office of Community Relations. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Erwin Boschman, who joined IUPUI in 1968, where he rose to professor of chemistry. He has taught chemistry at the undergraduate and graduate levels and served as consultant to chemistry departments in South America and Indonesia. He is the author of several dozen articles and numerous books on research and teaching. From 1988 to 1998, he served as Associate Dean of the Faculties. In December of 1998, he was appointed as Indiana University's Associate Vice President for Distributed Education. He retired from IUPUI in 2004, but remains active within the IU system. We are in the television studio in Kavanaugh Hall on the IUPUI campus, where we are recording using both digital audio and digital video. Dr. Boschman, I thank you for agreeing to this interview, and I would like to ask permission to do the following. To record this interview in both audio and video, to have the interview transcribed, to place the interview and transcription in the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives for the use of patrons, and to deposit the video with the IUPUI Office of Community Relations for such public relations purposes as the appropriate officials in that office deem appropriate. Is that okay?
That is okay.
Okay, then. I'd like to begin with your early years, so just so we can get an idea of your youth and your educational background. So to begin with, where were you born?
I was born in South America, in a little country of Paraguay, Paraguay, in the western region of Paraguay. This was in 1939 I was born. I lived there for about 10 years in the western part of Paraguay. My father had this, was a teacher, and he never received a diploma. And he was determined that his children would not suffer the same impediments that he suffered because he didn't have a diploma. So he uprooted the family and went to the capital city of Paraguay, which is Asunción. And we stayed there for the next, he still lives out there, as a matter of fact. And I stayed there for the next 10 years or so. That move that my father undertook on behalf of his family has been completely changing the lives of his children because we're now spread throughout the U.S. We're spread in Europe. We have five children. And we have an outlook on life that has totally blown the horizons of what the local people would have been. I still go back to see my father every year, as a matter of fact. And I still have friends from there from a long time ago. But my outlook on life is just completely different than what it used to be. So that is just a bit of the background of what I finished the high school in South America and in Paraguay, and then ran across a professor who had a Guggenheim Fellowship from the U.S. And I got to know him. I was just a kid of 17, 18 or something like this, and he encouraged me to consider college in the U.S. I had made plans to go to Europe, perhaps, and study something out there, but he said, try the U.S., you know, you might like it. I knew absolutely no English. I knew Spanish and I knew German, and that was about it, because the Spanish is what you talk when you're out in the world. But the minute you step out of the house, no German left. But at the home, it was all German. It was, the home and the church was German.
Can you describe why your mother tongue was German and your native tongue is Spanish?
My parents were immigrants as children from Europe, from South Russia. That was a German settlement, German colony, that had been settled since Catherine the Great. They came from Prussia to South Russia. Catherine the Great had offered them, I think she said, freedom in perpetuity. Freedom in perpetuity, which means forever, of course. But perpetuity stopped in 1917 when the revolution took place, obviously. So their parents uprooted in Russia and went to Germany first and then on to South America. They had no idea they were going to go to South America. They had hoped to come to the U.S. They had hoped to go to Canada, perhaps, but those borders were closed. If anyone in the family had any kind of illness or disease, like a trachoma, eye disease, The entire family was not allowed to go, and so they're looking for a country that allowed a couple of things. Number one, they would not fuss about the health problems. There's a lot of people had health issues. Number two, that they would allow them to run their own schools as they saw fit. They wanted German and things like this. And number three, they were also concerned that they would be given the religious freedom. And we're all Mennonites, and the religious freedom means mainly not serving in the army. They're quite willing to serve as alternative service, as they do in the U.S. when there's a draft, but not actually serving in the army, kind of thing here. There was no such country that was going to be doing this, but finally somebody said there is a country in South America, Paraguay, that looks for people that would populate the western region. It had never been populated by white people. And there were a lot of negotiations that took place, but eventually the government of Paraguay allowed thousands and thousands of people to come in under those conditions, essentially no conditions whatsoever. So my parents had been speaking German, their ancestors, ever since they left northern Germany, Prussia, and so on. But there was no indication whatsoever that they would abandon this at all here. So that's the reason that my parents still spoke German. They spoke a fairly good German. It was a cultured German. It was a studied German. But we had no opportunity to actually study the German officially within the city. So that's the reason my upbringing was in German since my mother's knee, kind of thing here.
Yeah.
But the minute you go to school, the minute you do go outside, it's all Spanish. So that was sort of the quick answer for that one. Yeah.
Now you came and went to Bethel College. Correct?
I did. The professor that I was talking about, his name was Winfield Fretz. He had a Guggenheim Fellowship, and his fellowship, as a matter of fact, was to study the unusual phenomenon of a German grouping of people to be located in South America, where it's all Spanish, totally different culture. So his Guggenheim Fellowship was to study us.
Yeah, your family. Yeah.
Well, not just our family, but the whole groups of people,
yeah.
many people. Today, there are some 32 different colonies, as we call them. Colonies are groupings of people, lots of villages, lots of people, maybe 2,000 to 5,000 people per colony. There must be 30 of these throughout South America. Mm-hmm. Not just Germans, but there are also Koreans, there are Japanese, and there are all kinds of people, because Paraguay is always interested in getting people in that know how to farm and so on. My people were all farmers. You know, they knew how to do farming. They knew how to work hard. They had the work ethics like, you know, most European people do. And so they were interested in that. And today, the economy of Paraguay is actually determined by the Mennonites. They determine pretty much everything, because everything is run by, not everything, a lot of good things are run by. In fact, the government has ministers, has senators who are Mennonites. Their governors in the provinces where the colonies are located, they're Mennonites. Lots and lots of the businesses, the huge businesses, the biggest business in Paraguay is run by Mennonites, kind of thing. And so it used to be that we were run by the local economy. It took us a week to get from the colony settlement to get through the capital city for the market.
Mm.
It took a week for the eggs to get there and so on. Today, there's a road out there, and today, not only do they not let themselves be run by the economy, they run the economy, essentially, which is sort of interesting development.
Yeah. So in 1959, is that when you came?
Yes. Sorry, you were asking about Bethel College. I didn't get to that. I came to Bethel College in, I think, August of 59.
Mm-hmm.
August of 59. Came to the Miami airport, had no idea what was going on. Somebody took my... an x-ray plate with me so they could determine that I was healthy, and they looked at that, and then on my suitcase they had put a patch saying this is where he wants to go, because I spoke no English. And so there was a big fellow out there who was just a porter, and he took my suitcase and put it someplace, and then he stood there and looked at me, and I had no idea what he wanted. And eventually it dawned on me, I think the guy wants some money for carrying my suitcase. So I pulled out 10% of my holdings. I had $50 in my pocket. That was all I had, and I gave him $5 as a tip in 59, In 59, that was an awful lot of money. So
yeah.
I was poor for the next 5 years or something. So went on the Greyhound bus. It took me, I don't know how many days to get to get to Kansas. That's where my college was located. And Meredith, I think the thing that I remember the most is separation of blacks and whites.
Real? Oh yeah.
All the restaurants, all the restrooms, they said. I think it said, it didn't say blacks, it said Negroes at the time, or colored even, it said color, and whites, and the water fountains were even so, and I could not believe that that took place. Wait, that was in 59, it was before that, so.
Yeah.
I got to Bethel College about a month before before school was to begin, and I needed money. I'd given away $5 for a tip some time ago, and it turns out that the maintenance crew actually did hire me to paint houses and so on, which I did. And the notion was that in the month I would learn some English, which I did, but it wasn't quite the proper English that I should have gotten. And so when I got into my class, the first term, they enrolled me in what here at IUPUI we would call W131. This would be English, and the basic English that you have here. So they enrolled me, and I had no idea what I should be doing. I promptly flunked that course. I had no idea what was going on here.
It's a good first impression. Good first experience.
First impression,
yeah.
Right? So I always, when people introduce themselves, and so if I run the show, I usually say, "Let's say something unique about yourself." And I start out by saying, "I'm unique because nobody else has this. I have an F in my transcript." So that means. But then sometimes people say, I have an F in physical therapy, physical education or something like this, and so that does happen here. I did take a full load at college. I also had a full job, a full-time job, and I just worked and slept and ate and just worked constantly. But I finished in 4 years and got my degree in chemistry.
Did you know right away you wanted to do chemistry when you first
came?
Well,
that's interesting. I wanted to do electrical engineering. Because I had been working in a radio shop while I was in Asunción, just repairing radios and what we call combinados, combines, that's radio and record player and things like this. You know, there were big pieces of furniture and so on. And I did that, and I kind of liked it, and I had opportunities to learn more about it from some fellows that were out there, and I thought maybe electrical engineering would be a good program. But there was no electrical engineering on campus. This was a small denominational Mennonite college in Kansas, in Bethel College, as you indicated. And it was in North Newton, Kansas. And I looked around, but there was a good a faculty member in chemistry, and he kept talking to me, and he said, "Well, what about chemistry?" And I said, "Well, what about it? I've taken chemistry in high school, one course or something." But so eventually he convinced me to take chemistry, which I'm glad I did. I mean, I think I would have been happy in electrical engineering had that been the possibility, or I would have been happy in mechanical engineering or anything. I just think that education is not does not mean that you need to go to a specific field. It means that how you determine the field and how you attack that field and what you do with the field is what makes happiness in life. And so. To me, that was nice. That was a good opportunity to learn chemistry, and then I went on to grad school immediately after.
In Boulder, Colorado.
In Boulder, Colorado. That's right. That was in '63, I believe it was '63. Got some recommendations. Went out there and looked for opportunities to live and so on, and I had a good professor out there who was my mentor He helped me understand a lot of the different things. It turns out I went to a small college. Bethel College is no more than 500-600 students or something.
Wow.
So a lot of the courses, especially the instrumental courses that we would have had in bigger institutions, we didn't have at the small college.
Mm.
So I had to I had to take some of the courses that others would have taken at their home institutions. These would have been instrumental analysis, it would have been analytical chemistry, you know, those kinds of courses that allow you to learn about them. Materials are quite expensive to run, like the materials in with the instruments. Most of the instruments are so expensive, a small college could not afford those things here. So I did that. Had a rough time the first semester, but eventually I got going on that, and got my master's degree, and I got my PhD at Boulder, Colorado, at University of Colorado, yeah.
So you graduated with your PhD in 1968.
Correct.
So,
yeah.
So what did you do then? What were your goals?
My goal was to find a job, at a time I was still a citizen of Paraguay.
Okay.
I just had a green card. And it turns out, I was looking around in 1967, this would have been a year before I would graduate, and looked on bulletin boards, and I looked at magazines, and I looked at ads, and so on, and I found a number of things. In those days, science positions were all over the world. This was called the golden era of science. You just about decided where you want to go, and that's where you went. And at a time, there was also the opportunity for a Fulbright Fellowship. And so I kind of liked the Fulbright idea, and I applied for it and then did get it, actually. And this was a Fulbright to go to Lima, Peru. Well, before I finalized that Fulbright, my professor came to me and said, I saw an ad on the bulletin board about from an institution in Indiana, they want somebody. I said, oh, I don't know. And so he gave that to me, and I looked at it, and I'm not sure exactly what the sequence was, but I did call Jim East, who was here for many, many years. He just passed away last year, I believe it was. And so I'm not sure how we followed that, if I gave him a call or wrote him a letter or something like this, but they immediately replied and invited me to come out. This was in the fall of 67, So, and I still had the Fulbright that was, I guess, in my pocket or something. And I'm so glad I chose Indiana, because the job market really dropped after that year, 68, 69, 70 or something, just really disappeared. And I had no opportunity to find a job had I taken the Fulbright, because you could not really find a job by a distance. If you're in South America and want to get a job in the U.S., it's virtually impossible to do that, especially if the market is way down, which it was. So that means I did go to, came to Indianapolis. Jim East picked me up at the airport. I remember the old airport was being renovated or was being built even. It's way before your time.
Yeah.
You have no idea. And we toured the place here, and I was a bit shocked about the many locations that IUPUI found itself in. I don't know if you remember the 902 North Meridian building, that's called the Turnfrye.
Yeah.
That was a building. There was a building on Delaware where the federal building is today. That was the central building. And we went up to this building. It was, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 story building. Walked into an elevator, and there was a lady sitting at the elevator thing, and she had this this thing that she managed the elevator up and down. You didn't touch buttons. This was the crank thing that she did, and she knew how to do it. That was her job. So we went up, and so I was a bit surprised, a bit taken aback by the archaic nature of IUPUI in those days. There was all these different buildings. Heron School of Art was someplace, and the physical education building was on 64th Street, I believe it was. And the medical school was downtown, nothing else, and so on. So, but because this was the job that they offered me, that they eventually offered me, had to do with going overseas. Because at a time, Indiana University, along with the other Big Ten universities, had a grant from the Ford Foundation, and this was, the purpose of the grant was to improve the basic sciences in South America, in Lima, Peru, as a matter of fact. And so, because this was an international kind of activity, somebody took me to Bloomington. I can't remember who that was, but I drove to Bloomington also, went to Bloomington, and we discussed this job that I would be having, not coming to IAPUI, but going directly to Lima. For 2 years, kind of thing here. And so at the time, I remember that a dean, I forget the person's name, told me how wonderful the IU benefits package is, which it was, but I really didn't know what benefits were. I had no interest in this. This was not where I was at. I was a young person. I was ready to go into life and so on. And so we also called the headquarters, the Big Ten headquarters for this particular Ford grant was in Madison, Wisconsin. So we called somebody in Madison, Wisconsin. I had a number of questions about this thing. And I'm interested in this process because no one ever asked me to give a seminar, which is kind of different because usually you give a seminar about your work, your research, your how you would teach a class and things like this, but no one asked us. They were simply concerned to find a Spanish-speaking chemist to go to South America. So I'm just an average person, but the fact that I spoke Spanish kind of gave me the advantage that I had. Now, mind you, I had no idea, I had no concept of what the chemistry in Spanish is like. I'd never taken any courses in Spanish, except in high school they hinted at something. But the chemistry is sort of based on the Latin language, and so a lot of the terms are sort of common in Spanish and French and I suppose in Italian and German, and so they use the Spanish, the Latin base. And so many things I could simply transliterate. But occasionally you ran into difficulties, like I remember I came to South America and one time we were going to be teaching about titration. Titration is a process that we do in chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, how are we going to say that in Spanish? And so I said, titración, which is the normal way that you would do it. You would simply add the C-I-O-N at the end. Instead of titration, T-I-O-N, you say titración, which I did. And the students all laughed and they thought I wasn't right. And so it turns out it's not titración, it's titulación. You know, it's just a small change. And so there are a few things like this that sort of made things a bit different than what they used to be. So I don't know what your question was, but I'm rambling here, I guess.
That's very good. Mm-hmm. Now, you spent 2 years in Lima.
We did.
Correct?
Absolutely wonderful time. They gave us a wonderful house. We had the colleagues from Wisconsin, from Minnesota, from all over. We just had a wonderful, wonderful group of people out there. Lima, Peru, I don't know if you've been to Lima. It's just a huge city. It's got, at the time, it had 35 museums or something. Every weekend we went to a museum. It has Cusco, the Machu Picchu, you probably have heard about, that we went to several times. It's just an absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous time. And we had a beautiful home, and when you rent a home, that comes with a gardener, that's part of that deal, and comes with a maid, that's part of the deal,
wow.
Comes with a car, that's part of the deal, you know, through the Ford Foundation, that was all. So we drove Fords at a time, you know, that was never. So we had an excellent time. I taught chemistry in Spanish to both of my colleagues and students. And I still remember some of the names of the people that I had at the time. It was just sort of an impressionable time at the time when I was young and impressionable and for students and things like that. You know how these things happen. So
yeah.
So we had a good time. My parents lived across the mountains in Paraguay, not Peru, but Paraguay. And so we had occasion to fly out there also and visit. Had a daughter, was born in Peru actually, and a daughter that we brought to Peru, and she was a year old when she came or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So, and a daughter was born out there, so. Anyhow, I'll let you ask to get back on track.
So in 1970, is that when you came
campus? Yeah, that's correct.
So you came back to Indianapolis. Did you live in Indianapolis then?
We lived in Indianapolis. So I came to Indianapolis, lived for a week in a motel someplace until we found some housing, and found housing on the northwest side here. just ran across this house. It's on 38th Street. It's still there. And I talked to the agent, and I said to the agent, I don't want to sign a year's lease. I want to buy a house. and furthermore, I want a fence around the house because I have small kids and so on. They need to be protected and so on. And she said, you're a negotiator, aren't you? And I said, well, I grew up in South America. You negotiate for everything, you know. You buy potatoes and you negotiate for those things. And so that's how we came to it. And she said, okay, if you, we'll give you a 6-month contract, and if you promised to buy the house through me, the agent, no problem. So we did it, and we had for 20, 25 years, good relationship with the lady. We bought many houses in town here as a result, and she's just an absolutely wonderful person. She was totally trustworthy, and so that's sort of a separate business that we got going in town here.
So after having lived in so many different, diverse places, did you see yourself staying in Indianapolis when you came back?
I did, because I married somebody from the U.S., and so that was kind of a major move for her to actually come to South America, because she grew up on a farm in Kansas. I mean, what do you know about the world when you live in a farm in Kansas, right? And so that means she was a bit hesitant about going overseas. In fact, our parents were hesitant. They wrote to me, the father wrote to me once, and he usually didn't write, but I knew this was important when I got a letter from him saying, may not be a good idea to go overseas, kind of thing here. But I persisted, I guess, as I often do, and I encouraged my wife, Priscilla is her name, and she eventually didn't say no, she just sort of agreed upon. And I said, you know, in the rest of the world, there's light and you can live and there's houses and things are normal out there. She had an absolute wonderful time being out there with all these wonderful restaurants out there. And just, so yes, it was kind of difficult to make that move, but I decided to stay about the time when I got married to her, which was in graduate school. Before graduate school, it was in college. I think we got married in college. And so pretty much I decided, but I had a visa and I didn't have a passport. But that was no issue at the time, number one, because I was married to a U.S. citizen. Number two, I was still a student at the time. And so they liked to have students. And also was a chemist, which is employable material here. But on one occasion when we traveled to South America, to Paraguay to see my parents, we were traveling all over land just to see the countryside and came to La Paz, Bolivia. And went to the airport, and my wife with a U.S. passport had no problem. I had a Paraguayan passport, which was the neighboring country.
Mm-hmm.
There was some stamp that was missing. I had to go all the way back to the city to get a stamp, and then I'm going to go back here. And I decided that was it. That was not what I like to do. So that's when I made the complete cut, and that was in 71, I believe, when I became a U.S. citizen, and I did it here in Indianapolis.
So it's 1971, and you are officially a U.S. citizen, and you're living in Indianapolis, Indiana.
I am. Yes.
What was Indianapolis like in 1971?
We had lived in Denver, and I kept the sheet going at the time as to what surprised me about Indianapolis. It was so, Denver was much more cosmopolitan, just there were radio stations, there were foreign language things, there were festivals from Poland, you know, all kinds of things in Denver. Indianapolis was provincial. It was very, very provincial. People just talked about going to Morrisville. They talked about going to, you know, maybe Carmel or something. They didn't talk big things. And that was a big, big surprise, a big adjustment for us.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when we first came to Indianapolis, that culture shock, which was a shock, was so intense that I started looking for a job elsewhere. That was one reason. The second reason was the fact that there were no mountains in Indiana. And we had been in Boulder, Colorado for 2 years, for 5 years, as a matter of fact. You know, lots and lots of mountains out there. Then we lived in Lima, Peru for 2 years, lots and lots of mountains,
yeah.
Right? And then we came to Indiana, and the tallest thing was my house, right? And that was just, somehow we just, so. Fortunately, during the process, I actually got to the point where I was third, one of a group of three for the new position that I was going to be. I was going to go back to Colorado. And we talked to our kids about moving, and they were younger, much more entrenched. They didn't have the past history that I did. And so the kids, I still remember, the kids said, if we can take our school, if we can take our house, and if we can take our church, let's move. And that, of course, told us that they didn't want to move.
Yeah.
They didn't want to move. And so we stayed. And after that, our roots went down, too. And Indianapolis became much more of a of an open city. I remember the downtown area was just really was a poor environment in need of urban renewal right here where IUPUI stands today. And it was just really, you know, we can probably talk about that later on.
So when you came back, you became a professor of chemistry.
Yes, first assistant professor, then associate professor, then full professor. Yeah, and that took, I don't know, I was 37 years old or something when I became full professor or something like that.
And where were you teaching at? What building were you in?
Okay. Do you remember 38th Street campus? You don't remember 38th Street campus?
I've heard about the Purdue campus.
Okay, there are two buildings out there. And that's where I spent, I had an office up there. But that's getting ahead of the story just a little bit, because before that merger, you see, I came to IUPUI before there was an IUPUI. In 68, there was no IUPUI.
Yep.
They merged in 69, of sort of on paper at least. It took a long, long time to actually do this. I was part of a group of three chemists here in Indianapolis. Frank Welcher was a chemist. He was a revered professor of chemistry. And Pat Boas was a professor of chemistry, Patricia Boas. And we were the Indianapolis component of Indiana University Chemistry Department. We heard about the fact that on 38th Street, there's a Purdue component also as a chemistry department. And so that was kind of interesting. We knew about these two groups. It's like, you know, you hear about colleagues at another institution that do the same thing that you're doing, right, teaching chemistry. And you hear about these things. But at times, they started talking about merging these two departments, and that became threatening for all of us. I mean, everybody was felt threatened, because when you don't know much about the other side, you sort of think that they're bigger, they're smarter, they can do more things, and they probably think the same thing of us, you know, that you know they're not as many as we are, but they've been here a long time. Frank Welcher is a well-revered chemist, and he's written many books and so on. And so that was probably a tense time to be told you're going to merge, and not knowing who are these people. So we got a list of people. And in fact, I remember Ned Shrigley, who was in the medical center, he was appointed by the chancellor to do a search for a chemistry chair, for a joint to merge the chair. And they searched, and chemistry had no input in this matter, which is totally unheard of today. I mean, there would be a mutiny if this would happen today. But at the time, somebody did a search. We weren't part of that search for the joint departments, for one chair for the joint department. And they found Will Fife, wonderful person, came from Ohio, and he was the person that kind of facilitated the merging, which he did a wonderful job on.
Fife, F-I-F-E?
F-I-F-E.
Okay.
Yeah, he's since passed on, Fife. So I don't know if you probably have questions and so on, but I can let me tell you about when I got the opportunity to come to Indianapolis for the interview that back in 67, my major professor said, you should know about Frank Welcher. And I said, who in the world is Frank Welcher? He said, oh, you don't know Frank Welcher. You got to know Frank Welcher. So he and I went to the library out there, and we looked in chemistry, and there were all these volumes and volumes of books that Frank Welcher had written. And I was going to be a colleague of his. And so he said, you better study up on Frank Welcher, which I did. Frank Welcher was at the end of his career. I was at the beginning of my career. But when I met Frank Welcher, he was such a humble person. He was such a kind person. He was a gentleman. He was just a wonderful gentleman. And the way he did research, there was no opportunity for research to write all these books. He used the library at Eli Lilly and Company here in town throughout the years. And in fact, he spent more time teaching at IUPUI, or whatever IUPUI was before then, than I believe any other faculty member ever. I think it's 48 years or something like this he taught here. I think it's the longest, I'm not sure about that, but I think it's close to being the longest that anyone has ever taught here. Eventually we got him an honorary degree from from the institution and so on, but he was a simple, humble, not simple, but a humble gentleman. Just wonderful to deal with. But the big surprising thing was that when I met him, I was placed in the 902 North Meridian building that still stands. It's now an apartment complex. It used to be a sports arena or sports building or some sports club.
Mm-hmm.
He had an office, and I had was given an office upstairs and so on. But he told me that years before, they were on the Delaware side, where Delaware, where the federal building is today. Mm-hmm. And he taught there all these years, never having an office. He had the trunk of his car was his office.
Oh no!
And he was this revered professor from known all over the world. He goes all over, gives talks and so on. He didn't have an office. He did not have an office.
Wow.
He told me. And so I was shocked. I was pleased that he didn't seem to be complaining about it, because other people needed offices and so on. But that was a major sort of insight into what Indianapolis is all about and what the IUPUI campus was all about before it was IUPUI, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought maybe it might be interesting if I mentioned to you some of the names that I heard about this place.
Mm-hmm.
And, see, I came in 67, I interviewed 68, and I got correspondence back and forth with there are all kinds of names that were used for this conglomerate of institutions that were all somehow related to Indiana University or Purdue University, who knew what, you know, they're a separate one. And one of the names that was often used was IUI, Indiana University, Indianapolis, I believe. And in fact, I was looking for some letterheads, I couldn't find any letterheads like that. But I think that was sort of a semi-official designation of what this institution was all about. Indiana University, Indianapolis, period. There's another name that is quite common, it's called Downtown Campus.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably heard that term, Downtown Campus. And in fact, I think this old letter that I wrote way back when, in June 16, 1970, you can scan a copy of it if you want to, it also has a designation Downtown Campus here.
Yep.
But it's 1970, so it's Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis, so that's official already. But it still says Downtown Campus, and it says the Junior Division Admissions and Counseling are at 902 North Meridian, and the administrative offices are at 518 North Delaware Street. That's the building that's not gone or something. So Downtown Campus was one. There was another name that was quite common, maybe in print, maybe not. It's called Extension Centers. Extension Centers. There was another name that was quite common. It was Regional Campus. Regional Campus was used. And there was another name that was quite common. It was University Quarters. University Quarters. So all of these names, and I'm not sure if anybody knows this exactly as to what was official, what was just bandied about. But I do know that the faculty did not have much of a attachment to these names. I mean, these were just names that are bandied about. You know, next week it changed to another name. If you went out to a conference and you put down IUI, nobody knew what that was, and so on. So it was kind of an embarrassing thing to say you came from IUI. But what people like to do always is to attach the name Indiana University of some fashion, and later on it would have been Purdue University. So the idea of merging the two was a good idea, actually, as it turns out. So I thought it would be interesting to mention those names. That building, the 902 North Meridian building, was a sports club, and in it had a pool, inside pool. And I remember we had theater productions in the pool. You know, the pool was vacated, and it was the audience, and we had some interesting plays that were given by the students in what used to be the pool, but now you walk down the stairs and you had things like this. So that was...
So you make do.
That was kind of unique, yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. But the office mate that I had, not an office mate, it was somebody next to my office, Charles Winslow was his name, from IAPUI, and he was in political science. I just happened to be next to him. And I was so intrigued by the fact that here I was going to be able to learn something about political science, which I knew nothing about. And he studied the Arab world. He had been to in Arabia many different times, spoke Arabic, I believe, had written some materials on it. And so it was really interesting to get to know Charles Winslow, simply because he knew something totally, completely different than what I had been involved in. So that was kind of an interesting thing here. But the other thing that I should mention is the a bit of the tension between 38th Street and downtown campus, as we
mm-hmm.
called it. we eventually saw the list, and I said, oh, these are interesting names. And then we looked at the vita for these faculty members that were at 38 that we were supposed to be colleagues with down the road. And saw the vita and said, oh, these people, they've done all these wonderful things. They're probably so much better than we are, kind of thing. And they probably talk the same way. But eventually we had our first meeting with this Will Feige, and he was a wonderful melder of different opinions, different fears, and so on. And he had us do some joint things, like, for instance, the annual reports were done on a standard form for both of us, and that was nice. But still, we retained our offices here. They had their offices at the other side. And eventually, I remember that I did have an office at both places, here in Indianapolis and here downtown, and also at 38th Street. For some reason, I had two offices. I'm not sure. The advanced classes were taught at the other place, and I was kind of coordinating the general chemistry classes that were on this side here. So I was back and forth between these two campuses constantly, which was not too good a deal to just go back and forth all the time here. And eventually we built a building here, so it brought the 38th campus here, and that's been quite some time ago. But it was interesting to me to observe the change in demeanor among faculty members, because when you're separated, physically separated, it's difficult to do anything other than suspect that they must be up to something. There must be some memo that's coming. There must be something that you don't see him at the water cooler, you don't eat lunch together, and so there's just a little bit of suspicion that developed. The minute the building was built and the minute people moved over, that changed completely. Mm-hmm. Just not because you did something different, but because you were close by. They're close by, and that's the same thing that I'm finding right now in my position that I have now. I have people of the same department in different buildings, and there's always this counterpoint between the two sides, simply because they're physically separated. You know, it's an interesting human phenomenon how that operates here.
Now, since you came from the Indiana University side, and you're right, supposed to be combining with the Purdue University right side, was there a problem with the missions of both schools when you came together in teaching chemistry?
You know, we didn't worry much about the mission. What we did have to worry about is the fact that there would be such things as textbooks that they had been using, and we perhaps used the different textbooks, and then we had to combine and get one textbook, because now the schedule was going to be one schedule for the two environments. And so what they did and what we did is no longer separate, but now it's going to be one. So the textbooks were one. The fortunate thing is that we did not ever have to go to Bloomington, have to go to Purdue to get permission to use these textbooks.
Oh.
We did it totally on our own here. And so that was kind of nicer. But in terms of the mission, I've always felt that the mission of Purdue is much more numbers-driven. It's much more clean in terms of we have these divisions that we have here. At IU, it's much more open. It's just a different philosophies of how you run institution. Obviously, Purdue has the engineering and technology, and IU has more the arts and sciences, and so that's probably part of that. And we felt some of that. We did go for advanced degrees, for a master's degree that we wanted to offer, and the PhD degrees that we wanted to offer. We had to go to the Purdue campus because they had the academic supervision for such things.
Mm.
Other than that, there was nothing. Even though our checks came from IU, yet our academic mission went to Purdue, kind of thing here.
Were there any problems in getting a master's or PhD program when your students are not coming from West Lafayette? Was there some tension there with Purdue?
Yeah, it took an awful lot of time. I mean, it's not just a matter of going up and saying, I want to do a master's program here,
yeah.
A master's program. It took an awful lot of conferences back and forth, and they had to convince themselves that we chemists in Indianapolis do some chemistry.
Yeah.
I mean, we had to sort of convince them that we were okay. And I don't blame them. I don't blame them, because anybody could come by and say, want to do a master's program. So it took some doing to get that pulled together. Now, the interesting thing is that you may or may not know is that when we joined this, all the science and all the engineering became Purdue missions. So we had to convince them, you know, any new programs that wanted to do had to go to Purdue. Okay. But the checks all came from IU, okay? However, there was one department, for some reason, that did not have a Purdue mission, and that is geology.
Geology.
They never had a Purdue mission. They always had an IU mission, even though they're in the School of Science, which is a Purdue mission, that kind of science. So,
Were they also on the same side of campus with you?
Okay. Yeah, they were the same thing. And I think that the reason, and somebody may challenge me on this, the reason is that there were no Purdue geologists at 38th Street campus. And the other fields all had faculty in both places or something. I think that's the case. I may be wrong, but that's an interesting thing here.
So what did your student body look like?
Student body. Yeah. The registration is the first thing I'm thinking about. Is at 902 North Meridian, there was this huge open space where people registered, and to register, you know, no computers, right? They stood in line, and they had these long tables out there where people were staffing these tables, and there was banners across there saying this is anthropology and this is so and so and this is so and so and so. So you stood in line until you got these things, and if there's somebody before you took the last seat or something, you were then out of luck, you know. But the student body was much like it is today. Hairstyles were different, obviously, and things like this, but it wasn't that much different, except that the technology was just way, way different than it is today. Just not much. It was a student newspaper, I believe they called it the Sagamore, mm-hmm. I believe, something like this, way back when. And in those days, we also had a faculty, they call it the Green Sheet, the faculty news that was broadcast throughout the faculty community here. So I don't think there was much of a difference in the student body, except there was fewer students, obviously, and also the fact that the students just had to take much more time and do it. Books were cheaper. You know,
that'd be nice.
Yeah, that'd be nicer. You know, I'm often intrigued about the phenomenon of IUPUI having been created in 69, and the fact that sometimes people put the demeaning names with IUPUI because, you know, what are you, Purdue, are you, what are you, kind of thing here. But then I think about the University of Chicago. University of Chicago was created in 1890. And it was placed in a slum area of Chicago. I mean, still is in an area that's not the best area.
Mm-hmm.
And people said, oh my goodness, what you're trying to make a school here in this environment? But what the University of Chicago did is they made sure that programs were of top caliber. They made sure that they had the top faculty members, they rated faculty members from all over, they brought them to the University of Chicago and so on. And in those days, they debated such things, shall we or shall we not have electricity on our campus, you know, 1890. And those were the big debates of the day, you see. But see, this was 16, this was 70 plus, so it was 80-year difference, right? 80-year difference between University of Chicago and IUPUI. And now we're, what, 40 years old or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
40 years old. I bet you, in another 40 years or something, none of this questioning about what is IUPUI is going to be part of the deal. I mean, there'll be so much world accomplishments from faculty, from students, from research and centers, from publications and so on, that is going to disappear completely. I mean, I'm just absolutely convinced of that, because it's just, I mean, there's so many models out there, like the University of Chicago models out there too. Yeah, in those days they had departments of typing, you know, learn how to type and that kind of thing. We don't do it anymore, you know, just totally gone kind of thing here. So.
Yeah.
Well,
as our time is running out, I'd like to talk a little bit about your time as Associate Dean of Faculty.
Okay.
1988 to 1998.
Yes.
So how did that change come about? How did you move into this new position?
I think the position was created. It was a new position when Gerald Bepko and Bill Plater became the chancellor and the executive vice chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 86, 87, something like that.
I believe Vepco came on in 86.
86, and then Plato maybe came the next year,
yeah,
or something like that. And I came the following year. And so they created that position, faculty development position. And as they did that, they put out an announcement to the faculty at large here on campus that this would be an internal search. And there were like a dozen people or so that applied for the position. They had some criteria, like it should be a full professor, I believe it was. It should be somebody who is interested in the campus development and things like that. But the faculty felt pretty much on their own in their own department, not the central organization that would help the university and the faculty grow here. And so I applied for the position, interviewed and things like this, and I got the position. Spent 12 years in that shop. And let me just tell you some of the things that we did. One of the things that I tried to do, we got some money, and I tried to make sure that the faculty would have an opportunity to compete for grants, research grants and teaching grants and things like this, which never had been the case before for university-wide environments. And so I was able to do that. We established a committee that was a system-wide, IUPUI-wide committee from all departments that would review these applications for grants that came through, that would read the dossiers that the faculty members that came, and they would then eventually decide yes or no in terms of the money that should go. So we did that. We also brought about such things as assessment was a big thing that came in the 80s or something, 80s or 90s, where it was a nationwide move to have faculty be accountable for the work that they do, and they call that process an assessment. And there were national conferences, and so we went to many, many assessment conferences, and I took faculty groups along with that. So that was a major move. There were many other small things, like we created the Center for Teaching and Learning. That's I'm not sure if you've seen that. That came about, and that was sort of a tense time, because I remember Bill Plato was not that. He is the ultimate approver of this. He and Vepco, but I really pushed this thing, and I was surprised at one point. He said, "Okay, let's do it," because I showed them several centers that had been successful at other institutions, and I thought that we should have the same thing. And it's a successful thing that's going, to this day. It's a big organization where faculty can go and learn about technology, for instance, or learn about any other tools. And they give a lot of different workshops on different areas. And so that's interesting also. So I did that. We created the Senior Academy and Center for Women and things like this. All this came under my portfolio. Eventually, I became heavily involved in the promotion and tenure process, and I was involved in that a lot. And then, as time went on, I got more and more of the solving the problems for tense situations. And I remember the first time I came in 88, almost immediately after I was appointed, there was a student in the School of Dentistry who was not agreeing with the grade that he got. He talked to his faculty member, didn't agree, talked to his chair, didn't agree, talked to his dean, didn't agree, and eventually came to the central office where I was. And I was given the job to sort of mediate that. And so we worked for a week or two or something trying to get these two parties across here. And eventually we did solve that problem. But that then gave me the opportunity, I guess if that's what you call it, to do many other things like this. There were some cases in labor studies, a severe case that we had out there where the Northwest campus had somebody that was not satisfied with what her school was doing, and she complained to what's going on here, to the central administration. And so I called her in, so I mediated this, and she didn't want to meet on this campus, she didn't want to meet on their campus, so we met in a town someplace between on 65 or something, like some Holiday Inn or someplace like this to do this. So I did quite a bit of mediation, actually, as it turns out, simply because they used to call me the Oiler. That's kind of interesting.
Now, you also worked with minority faculty, correct?
I did. I'm not sure if that was a separate office at all or not, but I did try to promote the minority. You know, I was always looked at as a minority faculty member because I grew up in South America or something. I was considered Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I have no Hispanic blood in me, I was born in a Hispanic environment. And so I work with African faculty members. I work with many of the African Americans in the city up here. And, you know, I've always admired people like Joe Taylor. You don't know the name, but he was the dean of this the school here. He was an African American. At the time, we called him Black. Wonderful dean, such a steady face, just steady course that he had always. And this was during the IUPUI growth here. This whole area was all small little clapboard houses.
Mm-hmm.
People lived here, didn't want to move. That's home. And eventually they saw that the university was in a 4, 5, 6 year buying campaign to get all these properties bought up one by one. And you went to these people in the evening and you talked to them. I didn't, but Joe Taylor did. And Joe Taylor was an absolute wonderful person that knew how to do that, to talk to the African-American people, because he was also Black. And so they let him in the door sooner than somebody else, kind of thing here. And he talked about the benefits of an institution. He talked about the benefits of moving someplace else. And he talked about the benefits of maybe getting a bigger house. And so it just took an awful lot of work to get that going. And I remember the discussion about shall this be called a separate university or not? You know, a lot of people had the name University of Indianapolis
mm-hmm.
before the University of Indianapolis has it now. It was called Indiana Central College, I believe, you know, what's now University of Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the name that they wanted for this. A lot of the citizens, Larry Borst was one of them. Mayor Luger was one of them. He pushed that idea. And there were other people. But as it turns out, that the university officials usually did not go along with that. They usually stayed on their on the notion of keeping it with IU, keeping it with Purdue. And several times there were surveys among the faculty members to do this. And these surveys, you know, I was involved in those as a associate dean for the faculties. And one of the surveys had to do with what about the name, or what about the shall we become independent kind of thing. And it turns out that the last that I heard, which was quite some time ago, they simply said, we have accomplished too much at this point to change our name. We want to stay with the IU, want to stay with the Purdue. BEPCO and Plater pushed that line all the time throughout. And I think Charles Bance does the same thing right now. We're past that issue, completely past that issue. But those are big, big debates, yeah.
How did that change your sense of an identity for IUPUI as picking a name to sort of consolidate as one school?
I didn't like the name at the time, and still have some issues with it, especially the chancellor, Bill Plater, and I, and a group of faculty members went to a conference in Colorado. I still remember that embarrassing moment. And we had all these institutions that were in this huge assembly hall, and the chancellor introduced us, the team from IUPUI, and he said, we're from IUPUI. And somebody way in the other side, he says, Uwe Pui. And everybody was quiet. You know, we just, nobody reacted to it. And I'm hoping that person was embarrassed. But I don't hear that anymore. I think we're past that. That's doesn't even spell right. You know?
Yeah.
I think it's a name like UCLA. You know, it's something you say, what does UCLA stand for? You know, IUPUI, what does it stand for? Kind of thing. I think that will become secondary as time goes on. I did publish, I say IUPUI. You know, that's what I say. So when you develop a sense of pride, it takes time. You know, you cannot develop it overnight. It's not like that. It's time. It takes a long way to sort of become part of your flesh and blood kind of thing. It's not instantaneous at all. Yeah.
Now you had been, you said you had offices in two different locations,
yeah.
And when you became associate dean of faculties, did you move to a central location.
Still had two offices.
Still two offices.
Not at 38th, but now at an office in Cavanaugh, this building in 317.
Okay.
That was my office out there.
Really?
And because I kept teaching a course a year, a course every semester, I believe it was. And then I had an office in the AO building, you know, also. I moved there several times. So I had these two places. And on 2 days, I think I came here first in the morning and went and taught class. And then I went to my office at the AO building, administrative offices building, kind of thing. Which you may remember, maybe not, that AO building was actually a maintenance building. It was built way back when, and it was not supposed to be an office building. It was just a temporary maintenance building, and it's still being used by the officers at this point. Yeah.
We need to take a short break to change tapes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
Okay.
Thank you.
And we're back. We had left off with you talking about transitioning to working in the AO building and then also in Cavanaugh Hall. But let's go back and talk about the community that was here prior to IUPUI.
Yeah, I thought it would be interesting to mention to you again that the community was really an African-American community. It was just totally, this was it. Indiana Avenue was their street. That was their environment and so on. You know, there were positives and there were negatives with that African experience that you had. You know, the Madam Walker building is right there, and that has a long, long history. So to tell people to leave is just not a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time I was walking out there with somebody, and he said, stand right here and look in that direction and count, and you can count seven churches with one. I sort of have to go just a little bit like this, but you see seven little churches, and they're all little blockhouse churches kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, now let's turn the other way and look again, sort of this one, and we found seven liquor stores in the same environment. You have the entire spectrum of what you have here. But the feeling was people are the government or the city or the institution, they're against us. They want us to move kind of thing here. And then, of course, the debate was always, are they giving us the right price or not? You know, this was always, they always get more money. And I think they had an independent body altogether that brought about such things as independent assessors for what the property is worth. And then, remember, the people used to say, well, that may be true, but I cannot buy another property like this one when I move someplace else where the property is much more expensive and so on. So that was an effort. I remember one example of when the Cavanaugh building was built. It was one of the first buildings that was built up here, as you may know. I used to park on the south side. There was no natatorium, none of those, just streets. There were houses all over the place here. And I took my son with me occasionally, and it turns out that the place that we walked past was, there was a little clapboard house, and there was a little lady who was always sitting outside with a little dog out there. And I always thought it was kind of a nice environment kind of thing here. But the poor lady always had such a grouchy face on her because she knew something was happening. She didn't know what to do. She was elderly. She didn't want to move. And yet she knew there was this big something that was happening to her and her neighbors and her friends and so up and down the road here. And I always felt, never talked with her, I always felt kind of sorry for her, the dilemma that she found herself in. It's like when a highway goes through your home, or you have to move. The eminent domain takes over, you know, and it's just not much that you can do about it. And so that was sort of, but to have the right people and to not rush things, to take time. People like Joe Taylor, you know, he was just such a smooth person in such an environment. It was a godsend, essentially, you know, to be able to do that. And I suspect a lot of the people weren't happy, even though he had good people, even though he did take the time. And there were activists that acted on behalf of the African American community that thought, you know, let's get busy with this. They went through the chancellor and so on. So anyhow, that was that about the community out here.
Now, as IUPUI is expanding and buying property, and you've moved down now to downtown area, to Cavanaugh,
right.
Did you get a more of a sense of there being a balance of the campus, or sort of a sense of one campus instead of all these separate units?
Oh yeah, especially when Heron moved over, especially when physical education moved over. They were at 64th Street or something like this, yeah. I think Heron was the last one that moved over, I believe. I think that was very much the case. They all became part of one campus. I think the center of gravity of the campus sort of moved over towards towards this side. You know, and there's always this ongoing friendly debate as to you know, the medical school versus the other campus.
Right.
You know, you've got the one side of Michigan Road and got the other side of Michigan Road, and all that. That's still going on. It's probably going to go on for a long time. Medical school still says IU, not IUPUI. You know, and you know, and a lot of these things, which is fine. You know, and in fact, I remember when BEPCO campaigned or was in the running for the chancellorship, he went to 38th Street and to talk to the faculty out there, and the faculty asked them, what about medical school and IUPUI? I remember that discussion, and he said, when I drive back to campus, I'm going to see a sign that will say IUPUI and separate will say IU Medical Center, and I want that sign to be gone. He wants it to be the same. Well, it never happened.
Yeah.
He never was able to do that, but I mean, that was sort of his, at least initial vision of what he wanted to do, but he may not have accomplished
it. I don't know if you know this or not, but do you know why he wouldn't be able to, when he became chancellor, to change the sign?
You can change the sign, but not change people's feelings about it. Yeah, and that's the main thing. I think part of it has to do with the fact that there was some debate as to whether the IU School of Medicine should report to the chancellor or should report to Bloomington. And to have won that debate that they should report to the chancellor here was a huge, huge accomplishment, and not the Bloomington kind of thing here. But the there's so many faculty, you know, it's just twice as many faculty as the rest of the campus here in the School of Medicine, and that means that the faculty keep talking at their conferences or on their when they travel or when they write papers, IU School of Medicine. And it's going to take a long time. It's going to take 25, 30 years for that to be disappearing.
Do you think that's something going on with IU Bloomington and hanging on to the medical campus, or is that something within the medical campus that they are an IU school?
Interesting question. I think Bloomington has a fair amount of difficulties with the growth of IUPUI and the prominence that it has, the visibility that it has in the city and so on. We call this the city's our laboratory kind of thing here.
Yeah.
And so I think Bloomington has a lot of difficulties with the money that flows into IUPUI. But I think the School of Medicine faculty also have some of that, and I think what it's going to take is it'll probably take a huge, huge, almost nationwide focus on IUPUI, not the medical school, but IUPUI, for something like a Nobel Prize, or somebody making a huge breakthrough in medicine, not medicine, in something other than medicine. For the world or for to focus on IUPUI, that's when medicine is going to say, ooh, they're really nice. So we'll be part of that. But it's not going to be in my lifetime.
Yeah.
I bet it's not going to be in my lifetime. Yeah. It's going to be a long, long time down the road. Yeah.
Now, you, as the Associate Dean of Faculties, you were working with around 1,500 full-time and 800 part-time faculty at IUPUI.
Correct, yeah.
So, what were some of the concerns or problems that you dealt with initially when you took on that position?
Well, the part-time faculty, they were essentially on their own. They worked with their department, that was it. There was no cohesive unit at all to bring the part-time faculty members together. So that was probably the biggest issue that we had. The 1,500 faculty members that we're talking about, obviously they, you know, I worked with them, but most of them were independent. They did their own thing, and so there was not much that needed to be done here, except when it came to promotion and tenure. And so we did a lot of those workshops where faculty would actually come to these workshops and so on, or when they actually go through the promotion and tenure activity. But the biggest challenge that I probably had was to get the feeling of isolation that the part-time faculty members had and move it into a feeling of oneness, of cohesiveness. And that took some doing. We established many committees, and what else do we do? And we have many conferences that we established. We had part-time faculty conferences, you know, brought in people, the speakers and so on. Had a few people initially, but eventually got more and more people that brought this together. And these were speakers that were able to talk across disciplines, kind of thing here. So I suspect that was probably the biggest thing. The fact that all faculty on this campus, including the School of Medicine, do go through the promotion tenure process on this campus is really, really good. One of the things that we brought in, that I brought in through the office, was workshops on how does promotion and tenure operate. And we did this for several years in a row, where we asked them, people who had been serving on a promotion tenure committee, and I asked maybe, there were maybe 13, 20 people on such a committee, I asked maybe half of those people to develop a workshop around that idea of how do you get promoted on this campus, how do you get tenured and so on. And we then had a workshop that we advertised, and we brought in 60 people at one point, I remember, came to that workshop out there. And so we ran it again the second time. But what we did is we developed fictitious dossiers. I mean, somebody that doesn't exist, just made up a name, you know, Jim Stone or something, mm-hmm. just any old name. And we developed a dossier around that person. It took a lot of work to doing that. And we did develop in such a way that that case was maybe a fence rider, maybe yes, maybe no kind of thing. Then we developed one that was totally bad. It was not good, not many publications, this and that. And then we developed, didn't have to develop, we took a good one that would actually went through, and we just asked somebody, can we use yours to as a model? We had three dossiers like this. And we passed those out to the faculty who were signing up to come to these committees and have them read them and decide for themselves what would they say on these things here. And then when the faculty came to the actual committee meeting, the actual workshop, they sat there, 60 of them or so, and they watched the committee go through these three as though they were an actual committee, an actual promotion and tenure workshop. And so that was kind of a nice thing. A lot of people came to those things and they liked this. And then we said, the audience is non-existent right now. You're all, you just flies on the walls or something. You cannot talk. But the minute the case is disposed of, you can then talk. You can then say, here's what I would like to ask a question about. And so a lot of people did ask questions and so on. That was, those are wonderful, nice things that we did.
Well, at this time, I'd like to move on to when you were Associate Vice President for Distributed Education. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In December of 1998, you received the title, or you were appointed Indiana University's Associate Vice President for Distributed Education.
Title,
yeah. The appointment was approved on January 22nd by the trustees of IU.
Okay, I don't remember that, but that's, yeah. Okay.
And under your new title, you were charged with designing and implementing new pedagogical models and technology-based delivery methods for all 8 campuses.
Wow, that's nice. That's wonderful.
So this included the oversight and responsibility for developing and enhancing instructional capability across all of the 8 IU
that's
campuses.
Great.
Gerald Bepko said about you, "Irv has been one of the trailblazers on our campus in the use of technology for student learning and faculty staff development, and we are confident he will offer superb leadership in the broader arena of responsibilities for which he has been chosen." So,
Boy, you did your research.
So why was it you? Why were you chosen for this position?
I don't know. It was a national search, actually, as it turns out. It was a national search, and I wasn't applying initially. And in fact, Bill Plater is the one that encouraged me. He said, you ought to apply for this. And I said, oh, I'm happy with doing what I'm doing here. I don't want to do this. And he kept urging me to consider applying, which I eventually did. And I have no idea. I mean, I didn't see the other candidates, I don't know, but I know it was a national search. And I do know that I put my heart and soul in preparing for the interview, for the kind of thing here. I prepared a fairly detailed white paper on what I thought distance education could be or should be for the IU system. I was thinking about the system and not IUPUI.
Mm-hmm.
And I also developed a PowerPoint that was fairly well thought out, and And I had a, I don't know, hour-long interview with the committee, the search committee, and again, I didn't even know the names of the other people, still don't know the names. You're saying, why did I get it? I don't know, except that I do know that some of the other candidates apparently did not have these materials that I prepared. And I passed these out to all the committee members, and even those that weren't present, so they all got the information. It was fairly detailed. I said, here are some things that I will do initially, here are some things that I will do during the process, here are some things that are going to take money, here are some things that I may not be able to do, you know, and so on. So my only guess is that that those materials, nobody ever said so, but I suspect those materials probably made a difference in the committee's opinion about me getting the position. Now, I did ask Ken Gross Lewis, who was my boss. Ken Gross Lewis, he is the chief academic officer of the Bloomington campus, and then also Michael McRobbie. I report to both of them at the same time. I asked him if he would be able to give me some feel for what I should be doing that the other candidates had said that I didn't say. Didn't propose, and he thought he could do that, and so he gave me some things, but I never got any names or something like this, and so, and I could have found out, but I just decided to stay away from that and not make it a thing. So that's what I think, but I'm not the best person to ask about that. You know?
Now, McRobbie said about you, Professor Boschman has made very significant contributions in the field of technology-enabled distributed education. And in his new role, he will bring his substantial expertise to bear on providing leadership, coordination, and focus in this area at IU.
Yeah.
So what contributions had you made in the field of technology-enabled distributed education?
Oh, yeah, well, that's fairly easy, because I was the first person that used the Lecture Hall 101. In the lecture hall. Where's the lecture hall? Right here, right?
Yep.
101 is the big classroom. I taught in a classroom for 25 years. And as time went on, more and more technology was built in there. Garland Elmore, he was sort of in charge of that, and I kept pushing him all the time. I want more technology. I want this. We had people that did this technology, and I had a system going where I had three screens that worked at the same time. And I had, let's see, one screen was my my document camera where I actually worked. Another screen was my experiments that I developed out there. And a third screen was the PowerPoint that I had going at the same time, or videos, or something like this. So I had three things going all the time here. It took an enormous amount of time to get ready for a class, because as you can imagine, when you have three things going at the same time, it just barely, complicated.
And this is an introductory chemistry course, because it's so large. Okay.
101.
Mm-hmm. 101, right.
Chemistry 101. It's mostly nursing students and so on.
Okay.
But I wanted to make sure that the nursing students would not be afraid of chemistry, because that was my main goal why I kept teaching that class, because I saw so many of these nursing students having fear of chemistry, much like mathematics. People have fear of mathematics, mm-hmm. and I didn't want that to be the case. So I try to make bring a human element into it. And I often had between 250 and 350 students in one class. And that Lecture Hall 101 holds about 505 students, I believe. It's quite a few students here. Yeah, so there are a lot of students that came through there. Over the years, I did count one time, I probably had about 25,000 students all told that I've taught.
Wow.
Not that I know them at all, but I mean that's just what's gone through my process. I had a good staff, about 12 teaching assistants that helped me with this, because we had recitation, we had laboratories, and we had the lecture and so on. And I had in the center core of the lecture hall building, I had two cabinets where I put the demonstration materials out there. And then the technology people that helped me out there, they were wonderful. I mean, they brought the videos that I needed. They brought the document camera. They brought they actually built a table with a sink, and so I could have the water and things like that. So that was all brought about. So I couldn't do it myself, but I was the one that sort of pushed and kept this going here. And I remember the at one point the trustees were meeting in town here in Indianapolis, and they wanted me to do a demonstration of what kind of thing I did do. So they were in the audience out there, and I did my thing for the trustees. But and so that's what McGraw is referring to, is that that I wasn't afraid to try. I usually went the day before to make sure things would work. And if they didn't work, you know, it wasn't the end of the world, kind of thing here. But we were able to bring some neat stuff, like, for instance, the Hindenburg. I don't know if you remember the Hindenburg, this big blimp that that exploded in 20-something, you know, way back when. I was going to make sure that the students were able to get a feel for, you know, what that must have been like at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had this video going of the Hindenburg going, and I had the chemistry actually developed. I wrote the formula of what's happening when this thing burns. You know, H2 plus O2 gives you water. Mm-hmm. And I had an actual experiment going with the hydrogen and oxygen, just boom, just really going on. So it really made a huge impact on the student, you know, get all these things in there at the same
yeah.
at the same time here. So that's what they're probably talking about, is that I was willing, I was young, I was eager, I was, well, not that young, I guess. But I like to keep trying these things. I went to conferences, a lot of conferences. The conference that Steve Gilbert still runs today, National Conferences on Teaching and Learning in the Electronic Environment. Plus, I wrote a book on the electronic classroom. I edited, lots of people contributed to it. And so, you know, all that together sort of, I did conferences, I did workshops, I featured faculty members on this campus, had several books, two editions actually, of the faculty members that do technology the best on campus. And so we featured, I don't know, 20, 30 faculty members. And then others felt left out, and so I brought another version of that in also, so that they could also be that. So all of that together sort of pointed out that this would be a good match for me to do. Yeah, so.
What triggered your interest in using technology in the classroom in such new and innovative ways?
Yeah, I've always been a sort of a techie person.
Yeah.
Ever since the days that I was a teenager when I repaired radios and so on. I think that's always been sort of fun to do, especially when I can see that there's a way in which you can bring a concrete skeleton to something that's an abstract concept. Because students, when they're 17, 18, when they're freshman students, they begin to leave the idea of thinking concretely only, you know, when you touch something, and think abstractly. But you still need the bridge. You still need a lot of abstract concepts that are illustrated by a concrete idea. And so to show a video is a concrete idea, you know. But when you show a chemistry and say, imagine hybridization kind of thing, that's totally different. And so, interesting that you asked the question. Nobody ever asked me such a question.
No. Yeah. It's interesting to me that you were educated in a time when it wouldn't have been used.
Oh, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
It was very concrete. And
right.
then you came into IUPUI, and for some reason you're very interested in using electronics in the classroom.
Yeah, I am. But see, today, that's all. That's all past that kind of technology. You know, people do course platform managements, you know, like Ali Jafari. You know, he works with that stuff, and he was a wonderful friend. He helped me with a lot of that stuff. In fact, he developed a lot of the items on the Electrical 101. He came every morning and made sure that things had, and he and I went to conferences many times, and we presented, and he tried to do things. I mean, he is, you know, step or two ahead of me, because I'm no longer doing that kind of stuff. I do people work right now, kind of thing.
Now, in 1991, your Chemistry 101 was made available on local PBS
mm-hmm.
and cable.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1997, your course became the prototype for the development of OnCourse.
OnCourse, that's correct.
So could you talk a little bit about how you got on PBS? And
Yeah, that was for, I decided that would be interesting to develop a course that would be beyond the classroom. And there would be two ways of doing this. One way would be to do it on television. And so we went to the studio and take my entire course. You know, I had a class actually there. We had students out there. They stayed out there, and we had this taped and so on. And we kind of developed, it had to be timed fairly carefully, so as you know. And so we did that. And then the chemistry department actually bought the idea, and they broadcast this on the local PBS station, like at midnight or at 3 o'clock in the morning or something, you know, some other time. But people recorded that, you see. And so people could actually take the class on TV at odd hours. And that went on for 10 years or something like this. Yeah. 10 years, I believe it is. But then later on came the idea of online education, and the idea of making it available to students who don't want the television thing, but they want to do it online. And we did that in my office. I remember I had a big bulletin board. I had, I don't know, 4 items on the vertical scale. I had 9 items on the horizontal scale, so 36 cells. And every one of those cells had to work. So this would mean, for instance, I would have demonstrations, and the demonstrations need to be done on the computer so they're visible, and so that was one of the cells, and so on. So there are a total of 36 or some number like that cells that need to work. I needed to fax out the homework. I needed to fax out the quiz. I needed to make sure that at the other end, there wasn't just a student, but there was a supervisor, the student who would actually receive that, not the student. So the student would go to the supervisor and take the exam and so on. So all that was, and we did that for a number of years. And so all that sort of brought together, I mean, that was all new territory, you know. I had no idea how to do this, and we stumbled and so on, but that's what we did. Yeah.
Wow. So do you know how you got hooked up with PBS in the first place? How?
That was not my doing. That was Community Learning Network, I believe, did that. At a time, it was, Jim East ran it for a while, did he not? I think Jim East did.
Possibly, yeah.
Or maybe Amy Warner. Amy Warner, I think she did it. You know Amy Warner, she's still here at the university. Yeah, she probably did that. So I never actually dealt with the station itself. The tapes were just delivered, and I was just totally, I mean, I was not part of that delivery system. I didn't decide when it was going to be broadcast. That was other people who was in the catalogs and things like that.
But okay.
Yeah.
Now, the School of Continuing Studies reported directly to you.
That's correct.
And that school offered programs in independent study, distance learning, and professional development, and serves as the academic home for degree programs in general studies, labor studies, and adult education.
Right.
And IU's independent studies program is one of the world's largest, serving 18,000 students annually.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about working with the School of Continuing Studies?
I work with the School of Continuing Studies in Bloomington, and have that nice old building up there in Bloomington. And I soon learned that there was a bipolar approach to what the School of Continuing Studies does and what the rest of the campus perceived that it does.
Okay.
And that was bothersome. It was bothersome in that the perception by the School of Arts and Sciences in Bloomington, or generally, was that the Continuing Studies does mediocre work. Even though they're often in the forefront of things, they do distance education, you know, they do all these students that they're serving out there, students who cannot come to Bloomington kind of thing here. They have good faculty like everybody else. And the people working in the continuing studies always had this feeling, you know, they felt it in their soul that they're not being respected as they should have been on campus. And so I try to get that together, but I never was able to overcome that. That was like a 50-year history that you're dealing with of this perception, you know, this perception that continuing studies does so-so work, kind of thing. You know, I'm not sure if they're really good. And then they find one incident that's sort of a sad incident or not a positive incident, and that's what's being pointed out all the time here. But I think, generally speaking, it's not something that's resolved or probably will get resolved. It'll still continue that. But they do a tremendous amount of work here, So I don't know.
And you also said that you reported jointly to Michael McRobbie
right.
and Mr. Lewis.
King Gross Lewis, yeah.
King Gross Lewis.
Uh-huh.
So what was it like reporting to two different people?
Yeah, that was kind of interesting.
Interesting.
Michael McRobbie is, I don't know if you know him or not, but he was hired to IU as the VP, Vice President for Information Technology, I believe it was, mm-hmm. Information Technology. And he was a master in information technology. I mean, when he came in, I knew that the work that I had been doing with the classroom and the TV and things like this was old stuff. That he was looking at the new stuff. He was looking at the computers. He was looking at the new wave of what's coming in. So I paid a lot of attention to what he was doing. So I I looked at him as sort of my mentor in the new wave of what's coming down the pike for this education, that's distance education. Ken Gross Lewis was not a technology person. Was a revered person on campus in Bloomington, you know, the most revered person on campus, probably next to Herman Wells, who knows, you know, just really, really well thought of. And he, I dealt with him on issues that had to do with people more than with technology kind of thing here. Like I remember we had a strong meeting in Bloomington where faculty members in Bloomington weren't sure that this technology was really the thing that they wanted to get involved in, so they had me develop a panel, and I developed this panel, and we spoke, and so Ken Gross Lewis was good at that. Or we had a conference that we developed in which we brought people from outside, and we brought some people in electronically, and we had a conference going both in Indianapolis and in Bloomington. Mm-hmm. And in the morning I was in Indianapolis, and then over lunch I drove to Bloomington, and then I was in Bloomington, and back and forth. And Ken Gross Lewis gave a talk about that. So he was more of a people person in helping to facilitate processes. Michael McRobbie was more of a technology person and helped that process. And so with Michael McRobbie, I developed the master plan for what distance education should be like for IU down the road. We had, I don't know how many recommendations and so on, but he was the one that was close and involved with that. You know, are you sure you want to develop this portion? Because, just back and forth a lot with that, yeah. And his office and my office were right next to each other in Bloomington building out there, and so we had a lot of interaction with each other. Yeah.
Now you'd said you're sort of using technology and you're enhancing education at the school, and you're talking with all eight campuses, correct? You're working with
in this environment. That's correct.
So, were you working with Purdue at all at this time?
No. Never worked with Purdue. I mean, I was at Purdue for a sabbatical. I spent out there, and I was at Purdue for meetings that we had, but nothing in terms of program development. That was all IU. See, even though it's all IUPUI, this is called IUPUI, mm-hmm. even though technology and science are Purdue missions, still the development of all new ideas, they don't come from Purdue, they come from IU.
That's interesting.
And so this distance education, or distributed education as we call it, is all IU driven. It was all IU driven. It's not Purdue driven. And so I knew fewer people out there, even though that's my mission.
Yeah.
My mission is Purdue. It's interesting how that so different. You know.
And now, since you're required to work with all eight campuses, did you start to feel disconnected from IUPUI?
Much more so. I mean, physically disconnected, because in our office in Bloomington, I had an office in Indianapolis. You know, I had two offices again.
You always have two offices.
I always had two offices. Yeah. yes, I did, because I spent much less time here in Indianapolis, and people in the regional campus wanted to get to know me. They wanted to know what's down the road, you know, what are we going to do differently, and their Center for Teaching and Learning at the different campuses, they wanted to know what should we do to get ready for this kind of thing. So I spent quite a bit of time in the Southeast campus, the East campus, the Kokomo, Gary Northwest, and South Bend, and place like this. I spent quite a bit of time. Didn't have offices in those cases, but I did have to go there quite a bit, and I got to know the people fairly well in those offices, and that was good. But it was a lot of people that just sort of bring together, and in fact, they helped me quite a bit in writing that document, the plan for the distance education for the IU system. So yes, I did feel a disconnect. I felt a lack of connection. A disconnect almost sounds like you're doing something that you weren't going to do it. It's just that I didn't have as much connection because even though I did have an office up here. The people are still the same. You know, when I talked to Garland Elmore, he's still here on this campus, or Amy Warner. I mean, these are good people that I've gotten to know over the years. And so a lack of connection more so than a disconnect, perhaps.
Now, since you were doing a lot more traveling and you sort of were able to leave the Indianapolis campus more often, how did you perceive IUPUI's role within the bigger IU system?
Oh. Today, I would say, I'm now looking from a much different position. I'm at the Kokomo campus now. And when I hear people in Kokomo talk, they put down, they say IU Bloomington and IUPUI, they put it in the same phrase.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know the history of, 1820 or something like this, that IU Bloomington began, something like that. And this began in 1970. So I would say they have grown in stature so much, they've grown in prestige so much, that for the regional campuses, they probably don't distinguish that much anymore. Even though a lot of the decisions will often still come from Bloomington, like international activities. They have an office here, but there's also an office in Bloomington. So they will often still refer to Bloomington for such things. But just one case in point is we're trying to develop a master's program in psychology at the IU Kokomo campus. And I didn't know if I have to go to Bloomington or if I have to go to IUPUI. Well, I talked to Sherry Queener, who is on this campus, and she said, you don't have to go to Bloomington, just do it right here. And so she wanted to make sure, and just got an email from her just a few days ago saying that, sure, you can go through IUPUI, you don't have to go to Bloomington, that kind of thing. And in fact, it'll be easier simply because we're newer and we do things a bit different, but you can get the approval through our campus right here. So I think generally speaking, Bloomington is still the mothership, that's still the big one. But IUPUI is newer, faster. I don't know, probably see some bias coming through here, but better. I don't know. They're just different approaches, Bloomington is such a well-developed, stately, gentle person. IUPUI is much faster, like a bug in water, all over the place. Yeah.
Now, again, with working with 8 different campuses, what did you learn from the other campuses that you could bring back to IUPUI?
Well, one thing that I maybe learned from the smaller regional campuses is the fact that so many faculty members know each other on those campuses, which is not possible at IUPUI, not possible in Bloomington.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that the fact that you have close connections, you're on a committee and you may have somebody in business, you have somebody in history, you have somebody in who knows chemistry or something like this, and in fact their offices are just the next building over, they're not a mile or two down the road kind of thing. That interaction is probably something that it would be nice at IUPUI, but you can't do it, it's too big here. It's probably something that we'll never achieve, but it's something that I learned and that I kind of appreciate about the regional campuses that I could have brought here. The other thing that I learned is that so many of the expertise, so much of the expertise that we have on this campus or Bloomington is not resident on the regional campuses. Like a technology person, not all campuses have an IT supervisor. They maybe share an IT with other people. It works, but it's just different, just different kind of thing here. Yeah.
Now, and you had an office in Bloomington as well as in Indianapolis.
Right.
So what was it like to be incorporating these new strategies and plans in classrooms and these new strategies, and yet you're working between several different campuses, and then you've got an office in different cities?
I do. Well, the implementation of my distance distributed education plan actually never took place. What I did work on is the thinking about it and the developing and the planning for it, but not the actual implementation. A lot of the different campuses, they work on the implementation, but I didn't do the actual implementation. I was more the let's go this direction, as opposed to here's a camera and here's the way.
This is how it's going to be done.
Yeah, how it's going to be done. So that's kind of different here.
So why did you need an office in Indianapolis and in Bloomington? Could you have just worked from Bloomington?
No, I worked from Indianapolis. I went to Bloomington maybe 2 weeks, 2 days a week or three days a week, depending which way it was, and meeting with people and so on. And what I did is I spent a lot of time with the leadership in schools. Like I remember in music, I spent quite a bit of time with the dean of music and trying to develop a feel, first of all, who the person is, and then also the feel for whether or not that dean can actually convince his or her faculty members to go this direction. Or I remember spending quite a bit of time in Bloomington with the business people, and again, doing the same thing. Is it possible for your faculty to, and the dean might say, well, I have three faculty who will never touch this stuff, whatever the case may be. Or the business people might tell me, we got enough money, we don't worry about this. We're not going to go this direction, we're going to do it our own. Because the business people, as you know, have fairly high tuition. They have $600 credit hours or something like that. And so they can go that direction. Yep.
Now, you've also received many awards in your career.
One or two.
I have here the Scholar Diplomat Award. U.S. Department of State.
That's before your parents.
1975, yeah.
That's way before your parents were born.
Well, my parents were born in the 40s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm the youngest, though.
Okay,
so that's
okay.
IUPUI Top Educator Award, 1978.
Yeah, that was
kind of
nice.
Danforth Associate, 1981-1990.
Yeah.
Herman Frederick Lieber Memorial Award, 1983.
That was the nicest one.
Yeah.
That was the nicest.
Why was that the nicest one?
It's such a prestigious award. It's the highest IU award that IU can give. And I'm saying that's nice because later on, for about 10 years or so, I was on the selection committee for that award. And I knew that was the top award. Plus, if you go to the Memorial Union Building in Bloomington, you have these plaques, and my name is on there as a plaque as a winner of that. So that's sort of the oldest one, and it's the most prestigious one. So I was really glad to get that one.
Yeah. You also received the Lilly Endowment Faculty Open Fellowship in 1986.
Cool.
Distinguished Alumnus Bethel College, 1998.
Yeah, that's my college. They gave me a Distinguished Alumnus kind of thing. You know.
Did you get to go back to Bethel for that?
I do occasionally.
Yeah?
No, I do occasionally. We just came back. You know, Bethel College, they've been after me but twice for the presidency at Bethel College. You know, they wanted me to become president out there. And my wife and I, we talked about it for quite some time, and we finally decided not to do it, even though they were after me for about 9 months or something, trying to convince me to move up there. But my wife wouldn't feel comfortable living in a glass house, you know, that's sort of be on campus, and they would know exactly what you're doing, and it just isn't her style, and so we decided not to do that. Yeah, but that was a nice award. I was really glad to get that one, and be able to connect with some people that I knew and things like that. But yeah, that was nice. It was nice.
Now you've also written many books and articles.
Yeah, way back when I wrote the chemistry articles,
mm-hmm.
and made sure that the material that I worked on, either in teaching or research, was material that I actually would make some sense to the rest of the world. And so I published this in all the Journal of Inorganic Chemistry or the Journal of Chemical Education. So I did that with this Frank Welcher that mentioned. He and I wrote a book together on the chemistry of copper. And that was sort of a nice book that we did way back in the 70s when he was still active, you know, here kind of thing, kind of launched me. And then since then, I've given up the chemistry and I've done more stuff that is more general, like the book on the electronic classroom. You know, it's not specifically chemistry, but it's a different kind of stuff. Or I developed materials about IUPUI, given some meetings at the national meetings and so on. So my shift has changed. It sort of shifted. It shifted. Most recently, I contributed a chapter to a book. It has to do with distributed education again, and this chapter, they asked me to write the final chapter, which has to do about the administrator's vision for distance education, or some such title, I believe it is. I forget what it is, but that's what it came out in at the beginning of this year, actually. And so that was nice to be able to be asked to write that and to say, you know, what should the administration do or not do in order to promote distance education, distributed education, as IU calls it. Yeah.
Well, as you look back at your career as Associate Vice President for Distributed Education, mm-hmm. what would you say were your most significant contributions?
To bring all of IU together into this mode that distance education is something that you should look at. Not everybody will, or can, or should, maybe. But a lot of people did look at that, so that was one. The second thing maybe was that we wrote a plan that was sort of a unified plan by all the campuses that charted the course for distributed education for IU. And we wrote that plan. Now, when you ask about the positives, you should maybe we'll ask also about the negatives. You know, what was the most disappointing in that whole process? And I would say it's the fact that I think IU gave up on the idea of distributed education. Yeah. And that was kind of a disappointment. All this work that went into it, and somehow they didn't see enough buy-in by the IU community or something. And the fact that they gave it up maybe too soon, or maybe it's a change in the environment as to how it's being done. Instead of done centrally, now it's done locally by each department, kind of thing here. So that was maybe on the negative side of that.
Now, in the pre-interview, we talked about how you had been working with all these different campuses, and eventually you left your position. You retired in 2004, correct?
Yeah, before I was provost at the East Campus,
right.
Actually.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved as being provost? How did you leave IUPUI and go into these extension campuses?
I was sitting in my office, and I get a call from Jerry Bepko. And Jerry Bepko, he was president of IU at the time. Mm-hmm. He was interim president, I believe.
Right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think during that time, he called me one time. He said, I've got these problems at IU East, they're cantankerous problems. They have four people with the title of provost in 1 year. And I said, oh my goodness, you know, that sounds like something I want to get part of it. He says, well, it's like taking your hand and sticking it in a hornet's nest. You know, I mean, that's the candid conversation that we had about this. I decided, sure, why not? I'll go for it. I mean, I did go to it and interviewed, and there were some other candidates, and I got the position. And finally, when I did get the position, I made sure that I would talk to all the faculty on campus, every one of the faculty members. It took me several months to do that. I was going to visit with them in their office for at least 5 or 10 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it took much longer than that, that kind of thing. Yeah. I did that. And then I noticed that a lot of people wanted to talk about the past, about other committees, about name so-and-so kind of thing here. And I always said, you know, I don't know that person. I don't know the situation. Let's just work from here on, and let's just go forward here. And that worked, apparently. So I was able to, with many other people, were able to calm things down because it was a jittery kind of environment out there. It was just, people were just on edge. Just bad things are going to happen to us kind of thing here. And I was able to, we were able to calm that down and bring that down. And then we searched for a replacement after I retired in 04, I guess it was, I retired. And we got somebody by the name of Larry Richards, who is still there out there. After, 6 years or so, he's still out there doing an absolute superb job. And it just totally calm. He is not a talker, but he's a thinker and he's a writer. Just the absolute right person for the campus out there. So it was, I had a super successful experience out there. I mean, I just really felt good about that experience. I mean, they gave me all kinds of Senate proclamation and that kind of stuff, you know, which is kind of nice. But I still like the people. I lead tours of South America sometimes, and I had one lady, she was my associate actually. She and her husband came along on a tour out there. We just had a grand time on this world. So yeah, I did that. It was a short time. It didn't take long, but in a matter of months, I kind of calmed things down. There were some people, again, that did not want to meet with me unless it's in a restaurant in town. They were that afraid or that angry about the system. I don't know. You know, people get angry about things, and I get angry too, but I generally just feel much more even keel, I guess. Than
the Oiler.
Oiler. Yeah, the Oiler. Yeah.
Now, didn't you write a tour guide book?
I did.
You did, yeah.
I
saw that you had.
Yeah. I did write a tour guide book about Paraguay, as it turns out. I haven't lived there, but I did a lot of research on that, a lot of photographs there, more photographs than there are pages in the book.
Wow.
It's kind of a take-along book. It's not a science book and not a chemistry book at all. Yeah, I had a good time writing that book. I was, and people buy it. It's on Amazon and things like that. Yeah, it's kind of fun to do that. Yeah.
Now, and we did the pre-interview. We did it at IU Kokomo. Can you talk about why you're at IU Kokomo? Why?
Well,
how did that
again,
happen?
I wasn't looking for it.
Yeah.
And this was, IU has this 1820. I don't know if you know about the 1820. When you serve the institution for at least 20 years, and 18 of those 20 years have been, the institution has been putting something into the kitty or something like this. Then at the end of your, at the beginning of your retirement, you then will get the same salary that you've been getting, but you cannot draw any other money from the state anyplace. That's 1820. So 04 through 09, I think it is, that was in my 5-year period, I could not draw any state money. But I was volunteer teaching at IUPUI, drew no money, I just started teaching up here. And then I also decided to teach at the University of Indianapolis.
Oh.
And that's a private institution, so I could draw some money out there, just a little change or something. And while I was doing that, I get this email from Kokomo saying, would you be interested in becoming the dean here for a year or two? I said, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so I said, let me think about this for a day or two, which I did, talked to my wife about it. And so it was just a cold call like that. And I said, sure. Whatever, and so that's what I did. And I've been there for a year now, and I'm now completing my second year, which is the term that I was asked for. And then the chancellor, we have a new chancellor, Michael Harris is his name. He just asked me the other day if I wanted to stay a third year. And so I don't know, as long as I live, I can do these things. Yeah, I'm having a good time doing it.
Wow.
Yep.
So as you look back at your entire career,
yeah,
with IU and IUPUI and the whole system,
yeah,
what are you most proud of?
Proud of? That I was able to stay within the system, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just so thankful to the IU system giving me these opportunities, you know, all these opportunities that come my way, and I don't ask for them, they just sort of show up. And what I'm most proud of would be that I've been able to do some things that the rest of IU, and some of IU, has paid attention to. I've been able to model some things for other faculty members. I've been able to help some people, you know, when you know, we're all in this world for a short period of time. You know, there are eons of ages before us, and there are eons of ages ahead of us, and so on. And we just have this short period of time. And the best way in which you can make an impact on that period of time is if you have a positive impact on people and fellow people that you have here. And so my I guess pride, if that's what it is, would be the fact that I've been able to make an impact on some people within the IU system during my short period of time that I have in this world, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as you look back, is there anything you would change or do differently?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think. Let's see. Maybe the distributed education, the way that ended, might have ended not with more consultation. You know, I said that's something that IU decided no longer to go in that direction that it go. I didn't feel quite right about that, the way it was done, the way it was handled. But I have no problem with it. I mean, if that's what the university decided to no longer go this direction, that's fine. I don't think I would change much. Had an absolute wonderful time. I been blessed with so many opportunities, and so I'm just wonderful opportunities. So.
Well, as we wrap up here, what was it like for you today when you walk on campus and you see, you know, mm-hmm. the campus center and the mm-hmm. library mm-hmm. and all the changes that have happened
right.
from the days when you were
sure,
all
sure.
over the place?
Yeah, right. I walk there and this little old lady sitting up there.
Yeah.
In the house, and now you see all these big buildings up there. Yeah, it's a sense of change, obviously. And I always tell myself, if there isn't change, the only other option is death. You know, if you don't change, you die. I mean, if you don't, you got to move. So I have no problem with change at all, with growth and so on. And in fact, I'm hoping that my children will do bigger things than I was able to do. I mean, we all, as parents, say that, that we want our children to have better life than what we than we had. When I look at the campus, I see the you know, the campus center up here. I think about the fact that Bill Plater always wanted the clock on top of that tower. I don't know if you know about that.
Yeah, I did. We talked to Rob Halter about.
Yeah, he always wanted that clock up there. I'm not sure if it's still in the planning or not, but maybe he said it's maybe an electronic clock, or I don't know what he wanted, but he wanted something magnanimous up there. In any case, I'm glad to walk on campus. I'm glad chemistry still gives me an office up here.
Yeah.
I still have two offices. I always have two offices. I'm glad I like the colleagues. They're all gone now that I used to know, but these are new colleagues and they do wonderful new things. When I walk, I used to walk on dirt coming from those clapboard houses at the campus here. Now there's no dirt around, you know, it's just nice, clean, and so on. I remember parking one time someplace on the north side of the campus here, and there was, I parked it because I thought it was not right for me to have to pay for parking where I work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of my personal campaign that I had against the
yeah.
system here, it was way back when I was radical or something. And so I decided to do that, and one time I came back and my battery was gone. You know, somebody stole my battery. So then I decided, okay, the system's trying to tell me something. I gotta be part of the system, pay your parking fees. And so I haven't walked on dirt since then. It's all, you know, clean stuff here, but it's just a nice nice place. I'm hoping that our students will become increasingly better. I think I noticed a huge change in the students. You know, I taught this morning in Kokomo, as a matter of fact, and some of the students are so dedicated, they're so committed to what they want to do. They're older students, and they have kids at home, and they got a lot of pressures, but the way they pursue this education is just astounding. I mean, how they just give their lives to this kind of thing, and so that's really gratifying to see that.
Yeah. Okay, well, I would like to thank you for coming in today, because we're just out of time.
Yeah.
So
thanks for all the research that did. My goodness, I'm impressed.
Thank
these
you.
Quotes that you have.